Hello and welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm really excited about today's episode, but before we get started, I wanted to give a big thank you to one of the supporters of today's episode. It is brought to you by Atomic Insights. For everything you need to know about nuclear energy and to listen to the Atomic Show podcast, hosted by Rod Adams, visit AtomicInsights.com. That's AtomicInsights.com. And you'll learn a little more about that later in the show. I also want to take a quick moment to thank those of you who, out of the goodness of your heart, out of the goodness of your heart, went on my website, CaraSantaMaria.com, shopped around in the store, and or click that little donate button to help support the podcast. It's because of you that I'm able to provide this 100% free to everyone who is listening right now. So here we go. Big thank you to Justin Ellison from Corona, California. I also want to thank Rick Richardson from Elma, Washington. I want to thank Norman Richards from Austin, Texas. And I also want to thank Tony Coles for your instant payment there. I want to thank Anthony Roberts for setting up a recurring payment. I also want to thank Greg Rogers and also, let's see here, Jeffrey Rich for setting up that recurring payment. That's incredibly helpful. It's super kind of you guys. And just a few more here. I want to give a shout out and a big thank you to Anthony Roberts from Burlingame, California. I want to thank Ian Paling from Ontario in Canada. I want to thank Brian Reich from Miffenburg, Pennsylvania. And lastly, but not leastly, I want to thank Gregory Wolski from San Diego, California. You guys rock. Seriously, you absolutely rock. Thank you so much. Again, this time from the bottom of my heart, not so much my hort. Well, my hort too. Okay, enough business. Let's get down to what you are here for, and that is today's episode. I am really excited to announce that I sat down this week. Actually, I sat down remotely with Jay Novella. He is a skeptical activist who is the co-host and producer of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. And he's also the producer and director of SGU, that's Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, video productions. And you can find those videos on the SGU YouTube channel. So without further ado, here he is, Jay Novella. Jay, thank you so much for joining me on Talk Nerdy, remotely, I should add.
I am so psyched to be here.
I am so excited that you are here. And I'm happy to say that this is my third attempt at doing a remote podcast. The first time I did one with Jeff Tony, Dr. Tony, who is the provost of Keene University. And it was a great conversation. His recording was a little quiet. Worked out that kink. The next one I did was just last week with Phil Plait, who we all know, the bad astronomer. Love him to death.
I love Phil.
Love Phil. He has great equipment. Didn't want to wear his headphones. And so he was like, your voice is very, it's not even coming through. And then of course we listened after and it did come through. So there was like a huge, like an echo thing that I had to work around. He's so sweet. He's so apologetic. I was like, really, it's not that big a deal. And great thing. Most people said they didn't notice, but it was a lot more work in edit. So yeah. Now I feel like I worked that out. Won't do that anymore. Worked out the sound thing, worked out the echo thing. Hopefully this recording sounds like we're in the same room. We'll see.
I hope it does too. Well, being that I've been doing this for so long and I'm, you know, I have good equipment. I hope that, like, you know, if you don't have this part in your podcast, I don't think people would know we weren't in the same room.
Yes, that's great. That's great. But we were, I was talking to Phil about it actually, and he was saying there is something to be said about like, eye contact and body language. And it makes me think of when I was on your podcast, Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, last week, and we were talking about this new algorithm that seems to have quote unquote hacked or broken poker, solved poker, but really it's just limit hold'em, which is a much easier game. But I made the comment that some of the younger kids who are the sharks at poker came up on video poker, on online poker, versus the old school guys who play at the table every day, and how it really is a different game psychologically. It's interesting to do these kinds of conversations remotely because I can't see you.
Yeah, I know. It is very different. I mean, the cues that you get from people when you're talking to them, and there is a ton of body language that you pick up. And we've gotten used to it. You know, I've been doing remote recording for so long with you know, even though some of the people on my show are brothers, it took a little getting used to in the beginning. It was a little weird, but then you just get totally used to it. Like, you can predict, like, what the people, you know, you get what they're doing, you get what they're saying. But the strange thing is now when we do live shows, which isn't really that often, maybe a few times a year, it's incredible to be in the room with them, because it's like somebody just turned up the whole, like, language thing to 10. Like, now I'm seeing them and we're smiling and there's so much different interaction going on when we're doing the live stuff. I love it.
It'd be so funny to do some sort of scientific study and see if you laugh more when you're in the... I bet you do. I bet you laugh a lot more when you're in the same room, because laughter is such a social mechanism, and it's so cued by eye contact and by body language. I wouldn't be surprised if those episodes have a lot more laughter in them.
Well, just think about the idea of how hardwired we are to react to smiles, to react to laughter, to react to someone just throwing their gaze at you. I mean, when you make real eye contact with somebody, you know, it's amazing. Like, if you analyze what's happening inside your head, mm-hmm. there's a lot going on. Like, you're feeling something immediately from anybody. You could be feeling, you know, awkward because you don't know the person, or you're uncomfortable with them, or if it's someone that you love or someone that you care about or have any kind of positive relationship with, it could make you feel invigorated or great or happy or whatever. Or maybe it makes you smile. Like, you know, so just a gaze could do so many different things. And I really do love the people I do my podcast with. So, you know, being with them to me is just like we're having a party when we're doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm kind of remembering this quote, and who knows, we always talk about quotes and we don't really know if they're, but I think that this one is an established quote from Bobby Fischer, where he said, "Nothing is so healing as the human touch," like, as he was dying, which is such an, even somebody who was struggling with, like, paranoid schizophrenia, and somebody who kind of always had a hard time with social interaction and with human contact, even somebody, for example, who struggles, who's on the spectrum, who struggles with autism or Asperger's, at a certain point in your life, even if that's something that's actually very hard to experience, it does seem like being touched by another person, letting another person in, just experiencing another person can have profound consequences, implications on your psychological well-being. That being said, we're not looking at each other right now. But the funny thing too is that anybody listening to the podcast right now isn't looking at us. And it has become so, like you said, you've gotten used to it. You've been doing this for 10 years. You've gotten used to it. That is the medium. People who are listening aren't in the room either. So we're for all intents and purposes, just as close / just as far to the people who are listening as we are to each other, which I kind of like. There's something kind of cool about that.
You know, there's something really intimate about podcasting to me. I have a good set of headphones on. You know, I can hear you very clearly. I can hear your voice better in a way than I can when I'm sitting across from you, because it's right on top of my ears.
Yeah.
It's just different. It's cool. Like, I just think I feel very close to the people that I'm podcasting, particularly if the connection is as good as you and I have right now. Like, I can hear you really well. Like, the internet is doing a good job tonight.
Yeah, Skype's holding up.
Yeah, so I feel a level of intimacy when I do this type of programming, as opposed to when I do a live show and I'm in front of a live audience. You know, sometimes I can't hear the people next to me as well as I can hear you right now.
Yeah, that's true. It is definitely different. I've had that experience. I've done live shows just as, you know, television shows with live studio audiences, and I've done some stage stuff. But just like you've done your podcast, both live and not live, I've been on Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, both in studio and when he does it live from the Bell House on stage with Eugene Mirbin. We had Wyatt Cenac on our show. So he's still got the comedians, but there's a whole audience. And even though there's a lot more excitement in the room and a lot, there's the vibe is really different, I find myself yelling into the microphone more. You know what I mean? It's like everybody's talking a little louder to be able to hear each other. And
are you Italian?
Yeah. I'm like talking with my hands so bad right now.
I wanted to tell you something that just popped into my head I think is really interesting. I've casually studied the different effect of audience size.
Huh.
that it has on me, right? So I've done live recordings with zero people all the way up to, I've been in front of thousands of people recording. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you that there is a difference between like 25, 50, 200, 500, and 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find that so interesting. And the reason why I find it interesting is, how could we possibly... It's not hard-coded. This isn't something that we're born with, like, you know, a feeling or whatever. It's something that it's come out of the noise. Like, it just shows up. It's like an after effect of having a conscious brain. That there is some type of social effect when you're in front of that many people. And the fact that the numbers have a difference to me is so strange. Like, why? Why does that happen? Why do I feel different in front of, you know, 25 or 50 people? Because the intimacy factor changes.
It's so changed. The bigger the group, the more neutral and less human-like in a lot of ways the group becomes. It just becomes like the public out there. It doesn't feel, you can't make eye contact, especially when the lights are bright. But when there's just a lot of people, it dehumanizes them a little bit. The less people there are, the more human, I think, for me personally, it is. And when I used to perform, I used to be a singer. I was a jazz singer, like, all through high school and early college.
Awesome.
Yeah, there's like my early career path. It's very strange. Ultimately, I left it to get into science. But when I was a singer, the funny thing too that I would tell people all the time, if I had a big performance coming up, I might have good friends or a boyfriend or a family member, and they'd go, "Oh, don't worry, I'll come and make you more comfortable." And I'm like, no, when you're there, I'm less comfortable. Like, when I'm performing in front of people I've never met and I don't know, it's so much easier. But
that's funny that you say that, because I just went, you know George Robb, right?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, so George and I met through the skeptical community, and I've been friends with him for quite a while now, like many, many years, but I had never seen him play drums live before. I've seen him play guitar a million times, but he is a professional drummer, and his second thing he does is he writes songs, and he's a guitarist, but his primary gig is a drummer for a funk band. So finally, you know, I have a kid, so it's like my free time is zilch. He invited us down, and a bunch of us drove down to go see his band. And he was telling me after the show that because of me, he broke drumsticks, and he doesn't remember the last time he broke a drumstick at a game.
Funny. Because he was just like, oh, he's looking, he's watching, I got to be good.
Well, he was psyched that we were there, so it pumped him up. But there probably was I got to do this. Like, I've got to show these guys that I'm a drummer and what I could do. You know, and he's a professional musician, like fully professional. Like, this is all he does. And he still was influenced by having a friend there.
Oh, yeah, totally, totally. And the more intimate that friendship, the closer you are, the more, especially like a loved one. I never understood. I used to date guys that were in bands all the time in high school. And some of them would be like, yeah, come support us. And I'd be like, that's so weird that you want me there. Because I've definitely had other, you know, ex-boyfriends that were in bands who were like, please don't come watch me play. And that's how I would be. Like, I love you, honey, but stay home, because I'm going to fuck up if you're there. I'm going to be way too self-conscious. And that's totally how I would feel. I've definitely got that kind of, I really care. You know, I think the people, everybody who, not everybody, people will sometimes look at me and they'll compliment me. And one of the common compliments that I get is that, like, oh, you're so cool, you don't give a fuck what other people think, which is hilarious to me because I so care what other people think. I'm like, I'm glad I come across that way, because, of course, everybody cares what other people think, but I, like, really do. And so that's definitely, like, being on stage with all the lights. Oh, God. I got to say, I love podcasting. I've said this a million times before. I love podcasting because I can do it in my pajamas. And I love it because nobody... it's so intimate, yet you're not looking at my face, which actually makes it in some ways more intimate, because there's that layer being a woman who says things that are controversial and says things that are intellectual and talks about content that's, you know, I think passionate and important, means that I piss people off. And it also means that there are people out there who will, on a YouTube video, talk the whole time about my tits. They'll talk about what I'm wearing. They'll talk about how my hair looks, which is...
Oh, boy.
Yeah, it's so annoying. And so it's like, with a podcast, what you can't do that. It just completely takes that layer away from it. And you're listening to the words I say, which, you know, for me is what I'm going for.
Yeah, I couldn't even imagine having to deal with that, you know, like... I'm so happy that I don't have to deal with stuff like that. Like, I would be... I would get so furious. I don't know how I would control myself.
Oh, like, I know. And you know, you're very close to Rebecca Watson, who has dealt with this for years and kind of in some ways has made it part of her career to answer this kind of stuff and to bring it into the light, which I think is amazing. And we all owe her a debt of gratitude for that. And it's like, I'm so glad she does it because it's the last thing I want to do. I'll talk about it sometimes, but I also worry about what ends up happening to a lot of women. And I think Rebecca might even to some extent be a good example about this, where you do decide to face it head on and go, look at what people write all the time and look at, you know, look at how this guy's being a dick and I'm going to bring it out. And I am a feminist and I do care about this, which of course I'm a feminist and of course I care about this, but it's like a fine line, because as soon as you talk about it more than a certain percent of the time, or you talk about it in a different kind of form, all of a sudden now that's what you're known for.
Yeah.
Now all of a sudden I can't do my other job because everybody goes, oh, that's that feminist who just wants to do this all the time. And it's like, oh, fuck you guys.
Yeah. Right. Like, you know, you can't cross the streams too much. You have to be careful. And I know that, you know, Rebecca has become, like, you know, very, very loud voice on the internet against it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I haven't ever heard her say this, or I've never really talked with her about it, but I bet you Rebecca would be much happier if none of this crap happened and she just focused on science and skepticism. And, you know, this kind of happened to her, even
of
though
course.
She would have been a feminist. It sucks.
Yes,
it really
happens
does.
To you. It's kind of like when you've got people on the far right who are like, you know, like pro-lifers, quote unquote. It's like just their name, like they're pro-life, as if we're not pro, as if somebody who's pro-choice is actually like pro-death. Like it's I see a parallel with that argument of people being like, well, abortion is a terrible thing. And it's like, yeah, it fucking is. I'm not saying it's not a terrible thing. I'm saying I want to have the choice that I could have an abortion if I need to, because fuck, I don't want to have the kid. Like that's a choice I need in front of me. But like nobody goes like, I want an abortion. Like that sounds like fun to do on a Tuesday. Like what a crazy thing that people on the far right, their thinking is so bizarre and twisted that they think that ultra liberal feminists like enjoy aborting fetuses.
Yeah, feels good.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is really great. It's like a massage.
It's,
you know, get
so
the fuck out of here.
Crazy. It's like, Jesus, nobody wants that. And it's the same thing here. It's like Rebecca, myself, you know, my friend Sex Nerd Sandra, my friend Kim Horcher, like a lot of people who are kind of in this position where we're women on the internet. Jacqueline Glenn, for example, the kind of atheist activist, we're women, we're on the internet. And we take a lot of shit, and it's how we deal with that shit is scrutinized almost as much as just us in life. And so then all of a sudden you have this secondary thing where you have to deal with people saying, oh, you shouldn't have said that about that guy, or you shouldn't have retweeted that tweet, or why would you engage with the troll, or you've got to engage with the trolls. And you're like, fuck, man, there's no handbook for this. And there are days when I just can't be online. And it's fine. I mean, I've learned, because I've been doing this now for quite a few years, I've learned that it's not about don't read the comments. Some people just go, don't read the comments. And you're like, well, it's kind of hard to be a good creator if you don't read comments, because you want to know what your real fans and your real listeners do want to hear. And you want to engage with them, because I want to provide content that people want. But you have to know what days you can't read the comments. Like, I'm kind of PMSing, or like I just got in a fight with somebody, or, you know, whatever it is, I'm feeling kind of shitty today, or like my dog doesn't want to hit, whatever it is. You're like, I shouldn't read the comments today because they're going to affect me today. But on a different day, it would like roll right off my skin.
Well, to do anything in the public eye, you have to develop a backbone.
Yeah.
Right. Like it's very hard for someone to really knock me hard off my game. Like, you know, if I screw up, I can admit it. I'm wrong all the time, you know, and I don't have a problem with being wrong.
Yeah.
If somebody like personally attacks me and it's happened, it's like, you know, like I could get upset, and sometimes, of course, I have, but most of the time, I'm just like, all right, come on, like, whatever. I've been doing this so long, you know, I feel very good about the work that I do, and you know, I have like a coping mechanism that's very developed in place. It's a big filter that everything goes through, and it works, you know. But it's funny, before when you said like the word feminism came up, and I didn't realize it ever before until right now when we were talking tonight, that I hate the idea that we even need the term feminism. To me, it's just human decency, right? Like the fact that you're a woman or I'm a guy, like I hate that we had to focus it on women because women get mistreated so badly and so obvious that it happens. But really, it's just people lacking human decency. I'd be curious to know if people that are people that take advantage of women and say the kinds of things that you described. I wonder how they treat men.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I do too.
I wonder if they're just jackasses in general, right? Right. This guy's just an asshole, and he happens to have focused his gaze on you at that particular moment. But you know, he might be talking, you know, behind his boss's back 5 minutes later when he actually does some work. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And if there isn't, like, I think that there are two kinds. I think that there are the people who are just like dicks in general. It's probably the same person who's trolling a million people online. It's just that his trolls towards women, his comments tend to be more like sexually aggressive or something. Or then on the flip side of that, I think you might have the kinds of men who, they experienced something when they were young, they got spurned early. For whatever reason, there is this, because I've dealt with people in my life and I can point to them and say, like, this guy hates women. Yeah. Like, this guy is so aggressive and so kind of like, I don't know, there's like a deep sort of hatred of like, I want to fuck you, but I hate you. And I know that you would just hurt me. And, you know, it's like this gross kind of sexually aggressive anger. And I've dealt with that in my life where it's so sad too, because I always try, I have this viewpoint when it comes to, let's say like actual violence, criminal activity. So, you know, like we're talking domestic abuse or armed robbery or murder or any of these like terrible things that people do. I have this weird part of my head that says like, I don't buy into the idea of evil, like quote unquote, I'm doing air quotes, you can't see them, of evil. I don't believe in religion. You know, none of that makes sense to me. And I think it comes from desperation and it comes from mental illness and it comes from, poor life choices. And so I always try to be empathetic and go like, if somebody does hate women that much, like something must have happened. They had some sort of experience. I don't think there's people out there that, well, that's just a bad dude. That guy's just a dick. I mean, yeah, but why? Like, was he raised by like horribly racist parents or by like sexist parents? Was he abused when he was a kid? Did he have some sort of humiliation experience when he was very young that involved a woman that like fucked him up? And that's sad. Now, it's still his fucking fault and fuck that guy. But at the same time, it's like, I wish that we could get to the root of that problem.
Well, I think it's really complicated.
Yeah.
I think, you know, part of it is, and I hate to say this, but I think some of it really is just the way that a human brain not evolves, but matures, and that there's so many weird things that can happen. And you know, I think, yeah, there are just people out there that would have, no matter what kind of upbringing they had, they would have just mistreated other people. Yeah. And possibly mistreated women. I do agree with you, though. I do think that there's a lot, you know, it's nature versus nurture, and we don't have to get into the whole thing, but I do think that both can have a dramatic effect. But you know, there's a lot of people out there with a lot of weird shit going on, and a very common weird thing that sadly that people have is just lack of respect and, you know, whatever, a weird perspective that thinks that they could say those things.
Totally. And I think so much of it comes from this emotional maturity, this idea of emotional maturity. Like, have you been in a functional relationship with another human being? Have you been able to tell somebody you trust how you're feeling about something and really get through what's happening in your head that makes you feel angry or that makes you feel sad or that makes you have a violent urge? Like, have you been able to talk to somebody about that? Because everybody has shit, like a lot of shit. Yeah. And it really comes down to, are you actively attempting to know yourself? Or are you trying to suppress all of those things? Are you capable of being empathetic with another human being and sharing those things with them? And that's why I personally, I'm very pro-therapy, which is a funny thing because I think the skeptical community is really divided on therapy, because therapy is one of those really weird things that the scientific data is mushy at best. Like, there are some places where you can tell that therapeutic intervention has a solid, you know, it's scientifically sound to say these people have better recovery rates after PTSD when they're in therapy, blah, blah, blah. But then like with depression, sometimes it looks like therapy is like a placebo. It really isn't much better than placebo. But I really promote talk therapy all the time, and not just for people with mental illness. I very much think that everybody would benefit from talk therapy because everybody benefits from having a person in their corner that they can tell everything to, that they can fully trust, and that they know is there for them to help them.
I agree. I totally agree. But there's one thing I think that needs to be said. There is a phenomenal difference from one therapist to another, and you need to find a good therapist.
Oh, so true. I can attest to that. I've definitely, you know, I've tried multiple. I finally have a therapist that I think is amazing and really helps me. But I've had therapists who were sort of aggressive and weird and too paternal, and I've had to go through a few. And it's just such a bummer that, like, our healthcare system, I don't think, supports that as much. Yeah. And that it's not something that we talk about publicly. We just aren't comfortable being like, yeah, I go to a shrink. It's awesome.
Yeah. The problem is, yeah, there's some cultural thing that developed. There's some, like, you know, men need to be tough stupidity going on.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also like, it's okay to have your arm, you know, blown off and you go to the doctor. Everyone can, like, understand that. But for some reason it's interpreted as, like, weird, or there's something wrong with you, you know, like, you know, you can't have an emotional deficiency or else there is literally something, you know, off about you.
Yeah. And it's like, I mentioned when I was on SGU last week on your podcast, I said something like, a lot of people look at depression, for example, or any of these, like, mental illnesses, whether they're mild or moderate or even severe, as though it's not a biological illness. It's not a biopsychological illness. They look at it like it's an illness of will. Like, you're just not trying hard enough.
Yeah.
Which is fucking crazy, because it's like the same thing with the liberals who are, you know, like myself, who are pro-abortion, who don't want to fucking have an abortion. It's like, have you ever walked a day in somebody with severe depression shoes?
Yeah.
Tell me they're not trying so hard enough. Exactly. It's like they have to try to get out of bed. They have to try really hard to get out of bed.
I have lapses of bad depression, you know, for no reason, just absolutely no reason. You know, a month could go by and I'm like, wow, I was in a bad place for this past month. You know, this comes and goes and I have to, you know, fight it every day. And I you know, I know the things that can get me into a good mood.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the things that put me into a bad mood. And you have to kind of, you know, be careful with yourself if you're susceptible to depression. But to think that somebody would interpret me as broken or not complete or not sound it's very insulting. It is. I mean, we need to help. The society needs to help people with depression. It's just like they can't help it, or they can help it, but they're not the reason why they have it.
Yes. And like you said, that it's like insulting to you if somebody were to say, like, well, you're broken or you're different or you're damaged. Like, imagine when you're in the depths of it and you hear that. It's the sad thing is it goes from being insulting to being something that you fold into your worldview. And then when you're in the depths of your depression, you start saying, I am broken. Maybe I am damaged. Oh, no. And I mean, when I'm experiencing a bad depressive episode, which I haven't since I started taking my meds, which is unbelievable.
That's awesome.
Like, it was fucking saved my life. Before I started taking my I seriously, that's how I would feel. I was like, I'm so fucking broken. Nobody could love me. I could never fucking hold a job down. You know, I'm never going to be successful in life. Just all those things that, and then other people saying that to you or saying that about you even.
Yeah.
Not so much to your face, but you hear people talk about other people and you're like, oh, they're talking about me. Like, what a fucked up thing. It's just, it's the stigma. And really what it is a fundamental, like you were talking about, this evolutionary mental kind of hardwired.
It's like a byproduct.
Yes. It's the truth of the matter is we are very negative towards things that we don't understand. We're afraid of them. We like to categorize them. We like to sweep them under the rug. Whatever it is, we have this power of positive thinking culture, which is so detrimental. And it's all like, well, if you just think good things, great things will happen to you. You'll just will the world to pay you money and give you riches. And it's like, fuck that. This American dream, manifest destiny, foundational thinking that we have is so dangerous.
I know. It's the ultimate simplistic worldview. I mean, if you dare to have a complex worldview, to learn, you know, how it is to run a life, or, you know, what does it take to be an honest human being, to witness your own behavior? Huge, huge thing. You know, like I said before, admit that, be able to truly admit that you're wrong and not have it have massive negative emotional consequences. There are people that live in that bubble, that sunshine bubble, where they reflect everything that doesn't fit their worldview. They reject people that don't think the way that they do. And they just surround themselves with the cushion. And those are the people that are more blind, and that are blinder than anybody. And those are the people I truly believe are epically dangerous.
Oh, they are. Like I say all the time, like I will publicly say that like I'm afraid of somebody like an Oprah Winfrey or like you know, we talk about Deepak Chopra a lot, but an Eckhart Tolle's not as bad as some of the other ones, but who's the one, Tony Robbins? Yeah. These people that promote those kinds of worldviews.
Yeah, they're like, you know, encouraging people, like they're beckoning them. Yeah, come to the cushy spot over here where you don't have to think and you just, you know, put your whole life on autopilot and just believe that the universe is going to make you happy. Like, get real. Like, get out of here.
Exactly.
Really?
And the whole thing is, you realize that that asshole made all of his money by, like, duping you. Like, you got duped into buying his shit. That's why he has that money.
Yeah, who is the man behind the curtain? And so I always look at that scam artist that way. There's a huge spectrum. You could have someone that completely believes it, right? I've seen people think that they have psychic abilities and they really believe it. And, you know, something very sad about that.
It is sad. You almost don't, you're not like as aggressively like annoyed with those people.
No, because I do believe that sometimes you can help that person.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you're in front of the scam artist, like the expert scam artist, the person that decisively developed the thing that they're doing to rip you off. Like this could be like somebody that is performing psychic surgery. That's that thing where like it looks like they're sticking their fingers in somebody's abdomen and they're pulling out cancer and all that. Like you have to prepare. You have to learn a skill to do that. You have to prepare. You have to bring like chicken parts and chicken blood with you and have a fake thumb on to pull that trick off. And it happens every day. Don't tell me that that guy's got his heart in the right place.
Oh, no. That guy is a charlatan, a by-the-book charlatan. Like he's selling snake oil to make money off of it.
Right. And these are the people that are being followed. These are the people that make the big bucks, you know. So I don't know. I honestly don't know who or what Tim Robbins really is behind those gigantic freaking teeth of his. But
yeah,
whatever.
Or Oprah even, you know, I always point to Oprah and people are like, oh, blasphemy. You said Oprah was dangerous, but it's like Oprah is the reason for Dr. Phil. Oprah is the reason for like so many of these people,
Dr. Oz too.
Yeah. So many of these people got their starts because Oprah gave them a platform and she's the queen of like power of positive thinking, bullshit daytime, make you feel all warm and fuzzy because you're depressed in your house,
oh my
cult
God.
Of domesticity. It's so depressing.
Well, the thing that really gets me is like there's an anti-intellectual movement that I don't even know if it's, I don't think it's an organized movement. It's just happening. There are people that are turning their backs on science, completely rejecting anything that science has to say. They're making up their own facts. They're labeling themselves as experts. You know, there are people out there that just, you know, literally by gut make statements as if they are based on, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars and decades of research. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like that is the ultimate and dangerous because look at what we have going on right now. We have things like an unvaccinated population. We have global warming. We have a pending energy crisis. We have a power grid that with an EMP could be taken out and the United States can be thrown into the dark ages.
And then like look at who is actually on the boards in charge of making decisions about energy and making decisions about environmental protection and decisions about NASA. We're putting climate science deniers on in these committees. We're electing far right oil, deep pocket, like oil I guess mostly oil and coal money, people who are taking lobbying money from them and who are voting. Like you said, I love that you were talking about with your gut, like Stephen Colbert's truthiness. People go, it feels right.
Yeah,
I'm going to say that because it feels right in my gut. Like, and some of these people are literal translation, like creationist, biblical creationists. Like they actually think the earth is 6,000 years old.
Yeah. Or maybe it's not round.
Like, what the fuck? And these people are in, like, the highest positions of authority in American governance.
That's the freak show. Like, who is putting them up? Like, you know, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that are voting for these officials that, like, wow, like, lack of education.
Yeah, but of course you're going to keep – think back to, like, when we had massive slave populations in this country. Like, it's easy to – keep people making bad decisions when you don't allow them to be educated. And that's a big problem too. Like it's like you said, there was this movement of anti-intellectualism and anti-science, and maybe it's not organized, but I think that there are to some extent certain puppet masters that are involved in this heavily.
Well, this is why I decided to become a skeptical activist. You know, I just couldn't sleep with all this happening, and the internet just, you know, throws gasoline on this fire. It for the good and for bad, you know, it's my platform as well. But
you're right. It's probably like 1,000 times worse now that people can spread hoax it. I want to get into the SGU and I want to get into your skepticism and your activism. But before I do, I got to ask you, did you see that Facebook has now started cracking down on hoaxes?
Yeah, I did. I want to see the real details and see like the actual events take place. Like I read a little bit about it, but I want to see like real statistics to see how far they're going to go.
It would be great because I know it's brand new. Like anybody who's listening, if you haven't seen this, of course on Facebook, I've had to do this before where somebody, for example, is like has hate speech on my page. Like they're like Islamist extremists sometimes on my page because I'm like super anti-religion. And so they'll like post horrible things, or I'll have, you know, like we were talking about earlier, gross guys who say things that are like sexually violent, or sometimes just a page will pop up that's like Cara Santa Maria. And I'm like, that's not me. That person's impersonating me. And so you can block and report on Facebook. And when you report, they file, and then they're good about getting back to you and saying, okay, we removed that account, or thank you for bringing this to our attention. But now in the drop-down menu, one of the little things you can click is something like, this person is spreading a viral news story that's a hoax, which to implement that at the beginning is a huge step.
I'm shocked that they did it.
I know, me too. I'm excited about it. You're right. I want to kind of step back and see if it works and how many people actually do it. But hopefully that's a cool way to self-police a community where we want, you know, we want good media. Like journalism is the backbone of our democracy. And it doesn't work when half of the people out there are spreading anti-journalistic or pseudo-journalistic content.
Well, you know, they say, I don't know if I'm going to say this quote exactly right, but they say that a lie could travel around the world before the truth gets its shoes on. You know that saying, it's like, it's so true. Like for some reason, you know, these provocative lies that are told all the time, you know, these, it's anything from, you know, a quick how to lose weight, mm-hmm, to, you know, how to cure cancer without having to spend thousands of dollars, and, you know, like all these different things that for some reason people get excited about that stuff. And it kills me because, you know, I've had to teach myself over the years, you know, to over 20 years of doing this. I can recognize scams. I can recognize, you know, logical fallacies, like, you know, just errors in thinking.
Yeah, almost immediately. Yeah, but a lot of people can't. A lot of people don't have the training to do that. And they just, why would they have the time? Like, you're an insurance claims adjuster. Like, that's not what you do for a living.
Exactly.
So you don't develop those skills.
And they're susceptible to these things because, you know, they don't know how to parse to get to the truth. And it's sad because not only are they being duped and wasting their time and energy and money and everything about their life into like these dumb, ridiculous, dead end ideas, but then they're also missing the absolute epic wonder, the absolute wonderful magnitude of science and understanding the universe. You know, like I feel so lucky, like, oh God, I'm so lucky that I happened to become this person. You know, I could have easily become so many other kinds of people. And I stumbled blindly down this path in my, you know, teenage years and in my 20s, and I'm reaping the benefits of really shaping my mind to see what I believe to be the universe for what it really is, right? It's cold and it's hard, but it's magnificent.
Totally. And you know, you talk about those scams, those hoaxes, those things that get spread around, and how it is sad. It's sad when somebody looks at that and goes, okay, I'm going to take that as fact. Or, you know, oh, my astrological chart, or if I just buy this crystal and wear it around my neck. And it's sad. And most of them are just that. They're just sad and somewhat innocuous. But it's the pervasive culture allows for things that are much less innocuous. Like you were talking about these, oh, cure cancer by taking shark cartilage. Okay, that, you know, but then look at what happened to Steve Jobs. And he's a prime example of something that happens to a lot of people. He's just happened to be famous. So we saw what it means to not take medicine, evidence-based medicine, when
Let's take it to the absolute worst conclusion. Very recently in the news, that little girl that rejected chemotherapy for her cancer and used alternative medicine, she died.
Mm-hmm.
She died. Now, think about this. This is why this torments me. A little girl, okay? She should not be having anything to do with her medical care decisions in the first place. Now, then you have the layer of completely uneducated and ignorant parents who are feeding her this nonsense. Like, she's just repeating what they're saying. So
of course, she didn't come up with this on her own. She wants to live.
Yeah, she would have. She wanted to live, just didn't know what the right path to get there. Her parents completely failed. Now, her parents, in my mind, killed her.
Yeah.
They neglected her into the grave. And we need to take action on this. The people are so stupid, we need to tell them to wear seatbelts and put motorcycle helmets on. We also need to tell people, use modern medicine to treat cancer, get your children vaccinated. Like, our population is not able, not everybody, of course, but there's a percentage of our population that can't make legitimate decisions on healthcare.
Oh, totally. And a lot of that is in my backyard here in LA. Like, when you hear about these measles outbreaks and these whooping cough outbreaks, they're always in fucking LA. It's because it's so funny. The places actually with the most means to prevent childhood illnesses are the places where you have these first world problems of these like hippy dippy parents saying like, oh, I don't want to vaccinate my kid because there might be mercury. And it's like, read a fucking book. Like, learn about this stuff, because you're putting everybody else in the country at risk.
Yeah,
everybody
totally
else. It's so, and it actually, it goes back to that thing you said about, you know, truth putting on its shoes before a lie has spread around the world. Read Seth Mnookin's book, The Panic Virus, because he talks about this. He talks about the early in the Lancet, the article that was published, the Wakefield studies. And how they were,
This was the guy that did the initial study, or the study that went in and tested to see if vaccinations had any link to autism. And the little unknown fact was that he wanted to show that vaccinations were linked to autism, because he was one of the financial backers and I think partial inventor of an alternate vaccination that he wanted to replace the existing vaccinations.
Yep. And he had like a tiny sample size, and there was actually some like real malfeasance in his reporting. And ultimately, the article, the one article linking these things, was retracted. But as Seth points out, you can say something and it catches people's attention and it spreads like wildfire. The retraction will never spread around the same way.
Be fully absorbed.
No, it's so hard to undo an idea. Yeah. So an idea that's right, that gets spread around, that's wonderful. But an idea that's incorrect, to undo that idea and to unabsorb it out of people's consciousness is almost impossible. I mean, look at us. We're like almost half a century later and we're still dealing with this vaccine autism debate. It's absolutely absurd. I want to thank Storyminders for supporting Talk Nerdy this week. Storyminders is owned and operated by Cheryl Green. She's sort of a one-woman show, and she started the company with the goal of creating a place to bring people with traumatic brain injury into storytelling and media. You see, Cheryl experienced traumatic brain injury herself, and she deals with disabilities caused by that head trauma. So Storyminders has since evolved, and she's since increased her focus across disabilities, offering services to podcasters, bloggers, vloggers, filmmakers, small business owners, and, you know, people with an online presence, pretty much anyone who's got something completely awesome to say. She will help you say it to as many people as possible. You see, about 9 million people in the United States are deaf or hard of hearing. And did you know that around 10 million Americans are blind or have low vision? If you don't use accessibility tools on your website or your uploaded documents, you're excluding people with vision impairments who rely on screen reader technology. And if your videos and blogs don't have closed captions or your podcasts don't have transcripts, you're excluding the deaf and hard of hearing community. And let's face it, losing a large number of potential customers. We are right in the middle of the information age, but the Americans with Disabilities Act and other federal laws don't cover most of what's available online. By not including disability access, there are entire segments of the population who won't be able to consume your content. At www.storyminders.com, you'll find the following services offered: closed captioning for streaming video, transcription services for audio and video content using screen reader accessible formats, accessibility services for PDF documents, and alternative text and image descriptions that increase accessibility of your blog or website. Cheryl is passionate about disability access. Not only does it increase your audience and your customer base, but it's a huge step towards inclusion and equality. It's not just an economic issue. It's a social justice issue as well. And guys, just for you, the Talk Nerdy listeners, Storyminders is offering a free consultation and 10% off of accessibility services. You can email Cheryl directly at info@storyminders.com to get started today. And for more information, visit www.storyminders.com. That's storyminders.com. Today's episode of Talk Nerdy is also brought to you by Atomic Insights. For everything you need to know about nuclear energy and to listen to the Atomic Show podcast hosted by Rod Adams, visit atomicinsights.com. At Atomic Insights, you will be exposed. You get it? Exposed to? No? You know? Okay. You'll be exposed to useful information about a variety of topics associated with atomic technologies, including atomic energy, the competitors to atomic energy, the risks and benefits of using nuclear technology, and the hazards of avoiding the use of nuclear technology. Rod Adams is the publisher. He's an independent atomic energy expert who spent over 25 years educating the public about atomic energy. He's also a retired commander in the U.S. Navy, and he hosts the Atomic Show podcast. At AtomicInsights.com and on the Atomic Show podcast, you'll learn how atomic energy can offer ultra-low CO2 power, why radiation should be better understood and less feared, how fear-mongering by fossil fuel industries has changed public perception of nuclear power, and a whole lot more. Did you know that per unit of energy, nuclear fuel costs about a fourth as much as natural gas? It's also less subject to inflation. The price is roughly the same in nominal dollars today as it was in 1975. To learn more tidbits like this and pretty much all you need to know about atomic energy, visit AtomicInsights.com. And don't forget to download the Atomic Show podcast, available on the website and on iTunes. So guys, again, visit AtomicInsights.com. Don't wait. That's AtomicInsights.com. Anyway, I want to talk to you about the work that you do, because it's funny, we're like getting to this at the end instead of in the beginning. But SGU, it's so funny because I know of you. I feel like almost everybody who is in this community, the skeptic atheist community, and even like the science community, knows of you. And a lot of people who just listen to podcasts know of The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. But that's all I know. I know that it's called Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. I've been on it twice. And I also know that I had Phil Plait on the podcast last week, and he said something so funny. He was like, oh, I wish I could remember the exact quote. Like, they're lousy with novellae or something like that. There's just so many novellae because you have like so many brothers. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about how it got started. Where did the activism bone? How was it born in your body? And then what made you decide to do this podcast and all the cool stuff that surrounds the podcast?
Yeah. Like, we were talking before just about, you know, where influences, like, you know, is it you're raised with it or whatever. I mean, my parents were very much into educating us. You know, my mom had a word of the day or word of the week board, like a movie marquee thing, and so just a ton of discussion around the kitchen table. You know, a big Italian family, and we were always just analyzing movies that we saw and TV shows, and you know, anything that we all experienced that we could talk about. You know, I think that was a huge part of it. I also just think we're that way. You know, I think it was just part of who we were born to be.
So it really is just your whole family.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's a, you know, it's funny. We have a sister who's a born again Christian.
You do? Okay, I was gonna say. I feel like there's always one person like that in the family who's different.
But it's interesting because my sister, first of all, like, I think she galvanized us. You know, I was 14 at the time, and Bob and Steve are 4 and 5 years older than me. So, you know, we all had to learn how to talk about religion and talk to her intelligently about why she's wrong, to put it plainly. So that helped a lot. We were already on the path. We've talked about this in detail with each other just out of curiosity. Like, yeah, where did it come from? But I know that was a big, accelerant for us. And then it really, I think it came down to like discovering Carl Sagan was a huge influencer. Like when you read, Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World, it just says it. Yeah. This is critical thinking. These are logical fallacies. We learned all of our basics like through his book, and then we started reading Randi, and then we started reading Christopher Hitchens, and the list goes on. And we started doing skeptical activism about, 30 years ago, 25, 30 years ago. We had, like a monthly meetup in a local library and a newsletter.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, cool.
And, we were doing that for years, and we had 80 people like in our group, or 83, I think was our top number. Podcasting formally started, like where it was just really hitting the scene. People were starting to hear about it. People were recording themselves and making it available online before like the word podcasting came out.
Yeah.
And then what happened was a friend of ours said, hey, we were playing like MMOs with each other, and it just got to the point where we would be continuously talking about news and whatever while we're playing these games.
Wait, MMO? So, yeah, that's like a video game.
Yeah, it's okay. It's where 100,000 people can get on and play the same game.
Oh, see, I thought that was like an porg or something weird like that.
MMORPG.
Yeah, massively multiplayer. What's the O?
Online.
Online, duh. And then role play game is, yeah. Oh, I gotcha. So you weren't playing role play games, but you were playing massive. Isn't that what it's like? Massively multiplayer.
Oh, they are role playing games. Like most of the MMOs are role playing games. If they're like kind of like D&D, like that type of thing. But there's all
like World
flavors.
Of Warcraft and all of those. Yeah, those are, exactly. Yeah. And even now, what's the one that all the kids play now? Which is like, they're like block looking people.
Oh, that's Minecraft.
Minecraft. That's one, right?
Yeah, kind of. It has a multiplayer aspect to it, but it's not like the fully fledged, like a real MMO, you could be that one, real MMO sends you on adventures. Like you have quests that you do and all that. Like Minecraft is about building.
Gotcha. So it is more like Warcraft. Okay. I totally derailed you. I'm always trying to learn these things.
No,
I don't really play video games.
Not a problem. And I think, you need a good hour education on this that we could do at another time, but I'll get you up to speed.
Cool.
So we were talking a lot, and we always enjoyed each other's company talking about all these different things. It could be from movies to whatever. And then our friend said, let's start a podcast. We'll do something like a politics or whatever. My brother Steve said, that's a great idea, but no, we're going to do a podcast about skepticism and you're not invited. Yeah, because he wasn't part of the skeptical activities that we had, but we stole the idea, started our podcast, and our 10-year anniversary is coming up in 2 months, and we've almost never missed an episode. Like once we got past like our the first 6 months and worked out all the kinks and everything, we've never missed a week.
And how many brothers? So you're on every week and Steve's on every week.
Yeah. So the cast, Rebecca just left the show. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if you knew that she'd been with us.
I did. It was like very recent, right?
Yeah. Like we just went on a 2-week tour in Australia and New Zealand, and we had a wonderful time. It was awesome. And she told us it's been 9 years. This has been awesome, but I'd like to move on to other things. And as much as like we were sad about it, I had to take it for what it was and realize, it was 9 awesome years. Like when do you ever do anything work related for 9 years?
Seriously.
So, we're still going strong. I feel like I have another 10 years in me, and I'm so happy for Rebecca and want her to have phenomenal success wherever she goes, whatever she wants to do. But we're just going to continue doing what we're doing and constantly changing and trying to make the show better and do other stuff. We have a lot of other activities that we do. So there you have it. So, we started this 10 years ago, and it's been the most important journey of my lifetime, except for my family and having a child. It's been incredible. Like I'm never been more proud of myself and feel like I've actually done something to help humanity.
And so how many Novelli are there?
Okay, so there's 5 kids altogether. So I'm the youngest.
I guess we should say novellas. Yeah. That's actually the appropriate way. Okay, so you're the youngest.
And my sister's the oldest.
Okay.
And there's four boys.
And then, so is there a real host? Like, is Steve the host, or is he just like kind of the bully?
No, Steve is the host. So Steve,
okay.
Steve is the glue that holds everything together.
And Steve is the doctor in the family.
That's right. Steve is a neurologist.
And so what he brings to the table often is the science-based medicine stuff, the evidence-based medicine.
Right. We're all good at different things, but Steve really is the genius. You know, I don't want to diminish anybody else, but like it is what it is. I mean, my brother Steve is the hardest working individual, except for my father, who even worked harder. But Steve works very hard at, you know, different things, right? Like, he's writing 5 blogs a week. He produces this show. You know, he and I co-produce the show, but Steve does all the post-production, which is 6 hours at least a week. You know, Steve, everything gets run through Steve. You know,
and then on top of that, he's a working physician.
Yeah, he's a neurologist. I mean, he does a full workload at Yale University in Connecticut.
Jeez.
And he and I still find time to see movies and play some video games and, you know, shoot videos.
So you live near each other?
Yeah, Steve is about 20 minutes from me, and my brother Bob, who's the other novella on the show, is 20 minutes in the other direction.
Oh, that's so great. That's so interesting. Do you guys live close to where you grew up, or did you all happen to move to the same area?
Yeah, we're all within about an hour from where we grew up.
Okay. Did you ever leave and come back, or have you just kind of always wanted to stay close to home?
Well, yeah, I did. I lived in Boston. I lived in New York City twice. And I loved everything I did. You know, I wouldn't take away any of the adventures that I was on. But, you know, everybody that I know, my family is here. All of my friends are here. I happen to really like New England. It's just too hard for me. I couldn't imagine myself like moving away permanently and just not having access to everyone that I care about.
So that must just really come from being incredibly close to your family. Like, that's really the driving force there. Because I come from a family who I love, but I'm not sure that we have that kind of close-knit feel. And I'm sort of the black sheep in my atheism, but also I'm sort of the black sheep in that I moved to L.A. Well, I moved to New York and then to L.A. And everybody's in Texas. Yeah, my mom, my sister, my dad's family, his wife, their kids, they're all in Texas.
Well, I get that. You know, I'm fortunate that I had a close, you know, family dynamic. But so many people I know are, you know, I think more people are from your side of the fence, you know, where you were the intellectual. You were the one that really, you know, you were the person that spent a lot of time learning and thinking and analyzing themselves. And, you know, I'm not just saying that your friends and family don't do that, but clearly there's something different with you compared to them.
Well, and I think that that difference is what made me need to leave, not so much to leave the nest or to leave the family, but to leave the place. I think that was, if my parents had been the exact same parents, but I had been raised in New York City, I don't know, maybe it would be different because I would have a lot of that cultural stuff around me. And that's not to say that Texas isn't an amazing place and that Dallas, I mean, luckily I didn't grow up in the boonies. I grew up in the burbs around Dallas. There's a lot of amazing stuff to do, but I just feel like there's so much more for me in Los Angeles.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you have a particular kind of mind, and it wasn't comfortable in Texas. I know a lot of skeptics that, you know, find Texas very difficult.
It's difficult. I mean, I don't know how David Smalley does it. He lives there. He does Dogma Debate there. And if I haven't plugged it yet, I need to do this quick plug that I do Dogma Debate every Wednesday. So if you guys haven't been listening, I do a really short 30-minute science segment on Dogma Debate every Wednesday. So that's fun.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I just started. So I say every Wednesday. I've done it 3 times now, but it's been a lot of fun. But yeah, he's there in Dallas. It's funny because we can talk. I can speak with some nostalgia and we can talk about Dallas and what it's like. But he's in it. In some ways, though, it's great because his podcast is this interesting community and it has this Southern vibe to it. And it has a lot of religious people who listen to it and they have real conversations, you know, whereas I doubt that I have a lot of really religious people listening to me on Talk Nerdy. They would probably be pretty offended listening. I think I have a few.
You never know. You never know.
Yeah, that's true.
I have a weird situation with my podcast where people who are religious will listen to it because they want to know, like, what's the other side saying? And we've gotten so many emails, like, it just blows my mind that this even happens. But they, a lot of times, will get an email and they'll say, I was listening to you because I just, you know, essentially was just trying to figure out what the other side was thinking and saying, and you actually made me a skeptic.
Oh, that's great.
Could you imagine? Like, I just think that is the biggest compliment I could ever get in my life. Like, wow, I pulled someone out of that snake's mouth.
And also, can you imagine if we had had that when we, I mean, granted, you were raised in an enlightened household. I was raised Mormon. Like, I grew up.
Damn.
And I was always a little like, ooh, this doesn't seem right, but it's all I knew. And if there were a podcast, if there were something when, and I'm you know, in my 30s, I'm not that old, but just there was no YouTube, there was no internet, really. It was hardly an internet when I was first in school. I didn't have a computer until third grade, and I definitely wasn't online until maybe like late middle school, early high school. But that's back when it was like, you know, AOL chat rooms and like Flash animation and IRC, you know, we weren't really doing much online.
I know today, like there is instant, you just add water and you have a community, right? Like you have,
it's so cool.
It's out there. It's really liberating. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I love talking to people that listen to my show over email. We'll get emails and I'll write back and I'll get kind of intimate with people to find out what their stories are and how did it happen and, you know, what influences did the internet have, did we have, or whatever, you know, whatever their story is. So luckily, yeah, the sword cuts both ways. Like, sure, the internet is full of crap. There's tons of nasty stuff out there that's wrong. But there's also us. There's also, you know, people like you out there creating, you know, really valuable programming that people attach themselves to and can learn from and get out of their situation. I think we're in an age of enlightenment as much as there's a dark age attached to it.
Well, I agree. And who was I speaking with recently? I had somebody on the podcast who was mentioning, and I love the way that they worded it, and now I'm like scrolling through who my most recent guests were because I'm blanking. Oh, it was Costa. Yeah. So it was a friend of mine named Costa Grammatis, who also does techno on Al Jazeera America. So he is a correspondent on one of the shows I'm on, and he is this weird, brilliant, evil genius who like made a bionic eye and like wants to buy a satellite to give free internet to people.
Love him.
Yeah, like dropped awesome. Out of school. Like he's amazing. He's so cool. Yeah. And like dropped out of school. Like he got his undergrad but never went to grad school, and like was a visiting scientist at MIT with a bachelor's degree because he like weaseled his way in. Like so funny.
I want to build an eye. Come
I know.
On.
I know.
So awesome.
It's so cool. And the really cool thing is he built it for a filmmaker who had lost his eye, and he was wearing a glass eye, but he wanted a bionic eye that could record so that he could make a documentary so that you could see what he sees, which is like so fucking cool. I know Costa's awesome, but he was, and now I feel like I've forgotten my train of thought. We were talking about the internet. What were we talking about?
Wow. Don't you love it when that happens? We were talking about,
you were saying that the internet is like all the, there's a lot of shit. Oh.
Yeah.
But also everything else. And I love how he worded it. He was like, it is a modern library of Alexandria. Everything is on the internet and it's never going to burn.
Yeah, you're right.
Like, it's so amazing.
Oh, and Kara, this is why critical thinking is so epically important. It's so important because the number one, you know, resource of information for humanity now is the internet. Mm-hmm. And the mere fact that it's just so rife with bullshit means that people need to learn how to navigate through this stuff.
And the truth is, there's no panacea for that. I can't tell you how many times people come to me and they say things like, can you give me some advice about what are the good websites to go to and what are the bad websites to go to? Can you give me advice about how to get, you know, the real science and tease it out from all the bullshit? Yeah. And it's like, it's a process. It's like, listen to SGU, you know, like take a science class. Like, it's not something where there's just a guidebook you can, and yeah, there are some tips. Like I always say when I talk about GMOs, and I'm pro GMO research and I'm pro learning about GMOs, and I've had a great GMO scientist on the podcast to talk about what golden rice could have done for people. And, you know, obviously if your resources, you know, gmoscansuckmyballs.org, like that's probably not a good resource. Like yeah. There are some easy things, you know, do they spell everything wrong? Are they only citing themselves? Are they trying to like shove their book down your throat at the end of the article? But sometimes it's not that straightforward. And a bullshit detector is something that develops over time.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it doesn't necessarily take a decade. Like, I don't want people to get intimidated or turned off.
No. And you don't have to have a college degree. You don't have to have studied science. It's something you get along the way, which is like a great bonus. But you can master it. You just have to be active about
it.
Right.
I mean, there's a handful of books that you could read that will give you a very quick and fast understanding of what critical thinking is. But you said it. The key word here is the baloney detector. It's you develop a filter that everything goes through, and it's not, you're not conscious. You're not like forcing it there. You just develop a consciousness about this stuff. So you hear somebody say something, and then, you know, after listening to podcasts and reading books or whatever, you'll go, wait a second. Wow, that guy just, that was a logical fallacy. That's wrong. Like, that guy is thinking wrong. His internal math is wrong.
And it's a little red flag that goes off. You don't control it. It almost happens passively.
Right. Exactly.
After a while, after long enough.
But Kara, why the hell don't we teach this in school? Think about how awesome critical thinking would be for, you know, young teenagers into college.
Or even younger, you know, and that's the thing that sucks is like you ask that question and that's a brilliant question. And it's so hard for me because I did learn it in school. Like I was one of the lucky ones. I was young. My parents put me in private school because I learned to read when I was like 3. And so they put me in private school because they wouldn't accept me at the public schools when I was that young. But my mom was like, she can't be home anymore. Like, she needs to go to school. So they tried to send me to school and they were like, she's too fucking young. She's not going to socialize. So a private school took me and I went to private school only until 2nd grade. So it was basically a glorified daycare. Yeah. It wasn't like a fancy private school where we wore uniforms or anything. It was a daycare, but they were like, okay, we can read books with her. And in 2nd grade, I started public school and I took the test that says, you know, this is like a tracking test, basically. Where are you? What's your reading level? What's your whatever? And I was testing so high that they put me in their academic gifted and talented program. And because of that, my entire course of my life changed.
Yeah.
I remember like part of what we do, we had a class called PACE. It was like Plano Academic Creative Excellent. I don't fucking remember what it stood for, but PACE was like the class that the smart kids in school would go to. And you would go to PACE with this crazy kooky teacher named Sally Smart, by the way. I'm not even joking. The teacher's name is Sally Smart. So weird. And we would do things like mock trial and Odyssey of the Mind and future problem solving and all these competition things. But class would be logic puzzles.
Yeah.
You know, class would be like solving creative problems. Like that's what we did in school. They would pull us out of our regular classes and we'd go to PACE for however many hours and literally do like logic puzzles together. So I'm very lucky that I had that kind of training from the time I was young. But I don't understand. That didn't need to be a gifted and talented program. That should have been an every kid program.
It should be Common Core. I mean,
totally.
Right.
Totally.
It is a methodology to thinking and analyzing information. And when it truly becomes unconscious for you, when you've learned enough about it where you don't have to really concentrate, it just gives it to you, it's the most profound thing to have in your head because it helps you every single second that information is going in.
Oh, completely. And it helps you in every potential career path you could take. Every potential career path to have a bullshit detector, to be able to think logically and in an evidence-based way is going to benefit you. And I am blown away. Back when I used to teach at the university level because as I was working in graduate school and in between my degrees, I would always take a year off. I would be either an adjunct professor or before I had my master's, I was, you know, called it a TA, but I did the same job. I just made less money. And I would have kids coming in, freshman college kids taking Bio 101. Or freshman psychology kids taking Psych 101. And I saw how very few of them could think in a logical way. Like very few of them could do the thing where like, okay, design an experiment. How can you disprove your hypothesis? Like what are some of the questions that you could ask and how can we systematically go through? And just simple things where maybe I didn't give you the answer. We didn't learn that exact answer in class, but we learned the tools to get to that answer, yet you're having a really hard time getting to that answer.
Could you
because
imagine,
you keep perseverating.
Oh, God, yeah. 12 years of education before you get to college, right?
Mm-hmm.
12 years. And they say that the vast majority of that is just brain training. You're not like absorbing every single piece of information and remembering anything. I mean, just brain exercise.
And nor should you.
Of course not. No, yeah. But the point is, out of those 12 years, there is not one hour of formalized critical thinking. And, you know, the term critical thinking might sound really stuffy, but it's anything but. Critical thinking is like it is the kind of tool. It's how do I put this? Like I want to make sure that I say this in the right way. Mm-hmm. It is the kind of tool that has an impact on all your other learning. It has an impact on all the other thinking that you do. It literally is like when you play the game of chess. How do you play chess? What are the rules? That's critical thinking to just owning a brain.
Yeah, it's problem solving. That's all it is. It's like, it's so fundamental to everything else, and the fact that it's not in the curriculum, it blows my mind. And a lot of people had access to it because they had good teachers.
Yeah,
because
the teachers bring it understood. On their own. Yep.
They bring it on their own. They add it to the curriculum, but a lot of people didn't because they didn't have teachers that took it upon themselves to do that. It's the same thing. It blows my mind, too, that in the first 12 years of most people's academic career, which for a lot of people is their only academic career, by the time they graduate high school, what else is not in the core curriculum, in at least in high school? Philosophy.
Yeah.
Nobody takes philosophy in high school. I've never heard of a philosophy. I mean, maybe like a really cool magnet school or something, but it's just not part of the, which to me is fucking bizarre. Like when you go through undergrad, if you get a master's and then you go on and you get an advanced degree, unless it's a specialized degree like medicine or like a JD, like in law school, it's a PhD. It is a doctorate of philosophy.
Yep.
The whole point here, even if it's in English or in math or whatever, the whole point here is to learn to be a philosophical thinker.
Yeah.
To understand the underpinnings.
There is definitely legitimate and very valuable logic in studying philosophy. I think philosophy is an awesome thing to learn about. And I agree with you. It's just really, it's not there. If it's there, it's not there enough. There's not a footprint big enough for these types of things, these types of brain training exercises that stick with you, right? Do you remember your American history? Like, how much do you really remember of all those classes that you had to take?
Oh, there are certain classes where I literally remember nothing. And I say that too. Like, when I teach a class, like, I don't give a shit how much of this stuff you actually remember. Like, you have the internet. You can look it up. Like, I want you to learn how to think.
Right.
I want you to learn how to be able to look up the answer and know the difference between the right answer and the wrong answer.
So you care as much as you don't want to admit it, you really are a skeptic.
Oh, yeah, I'm a skeptic. Yeah, I'll admit it. Yeah.
I mean, that is your designation. I mean, you're a lot of things, but you're a hardcore critical thinker.
I try to be. I think the thing about the skeptic movement that doesn't float my boat, and maybe it's just not personally interesting to me, is the stuff that you guys dip into it a bit, but not as much as others. But the stuff that James Randi, who is amazing, is so good at. It's like the magic stuff. It's like debunking of like psychics and debunking of like cryptozoology and that kind of stuff. It's just not that interesting to me. I think I get that it's a public service, and I so appreciate that there are people in the skeptic community who are like really into this. It's activism. It's what you guys do. And I so am appreciative of it because that means like I don't have to put my energy into it. It's just not something. And maybe it's just because I'm a natural born skeptic and I'm like, of course that's bullshit. Let's move on. Yeah, I'm more into like skepticism in politics. I'm more into skepticism in social justice and things like that. I'm less interested in, you know, is this guy a charlatan?
Well, there are all different flavors, like just like everything else. Like there's different kinds of critical thinkers and the ways that people, bring skepticism to life. Right. So back in the day with Randi and Joe Nickell and a lot of other people that were doing like the quote unquote debunking and all that, that was really important at that time in history.
That's true, actually, because people were being swindled left and right.
But they built the foundation. They helped become a part of the foundation of the modern movement today, which really, you know, it still incorporates those things. Like there's always going to be someone saying that they see Bigfoot, and there always needs to be a skeptic saying you're full of shit. Right.
Totally.
But
there is it has the burden of proof has like shifted to such a large extent that like most people, if you do a show about like finding Bigfoot, most people are like, those people are crazy. Like there's still some people who are like, yeah, I think Bigfoot could be a thing. But I think it's now the minority.
Well, I don't know. Let me give you a different perspective on that.
Okay.
Like, was it the Discovery Channel did their Megalodon bullshit?
Oh,
like,
the extinct shark.
And the mermaid, like the literally
mermaid,
like 2-hour mermaid special, like these shows rate phenomenally high. Now, that might be, you know, skewed statistics because, you know, the same people might be watching these same shows or whatever. But there's a lot of people out there that buy into this stuff. Now, how much of it is entertainment value? You know, they build those shows to be very dramatic or whatever. But people are watching that.
And the problem, too, is that they're so good at sounding scientific about it.
Oh, and they're masters at drama.
Yeah,
they're great at dramatizing nothing. It could be, you know, you could hear someone step on a leaf and they can turn that into there was a ghost, you know, whatever. But the point is, I find that when you cut up the skeptical community and you look at the different things that people are doing or whatever, everyone pretty much has their place and it's good. Like, you know, I'm focusing on, you know, news, like current news. And, you know, mm-hmm. I love to talk about, you know, science in movies and science in the news and what's good and what's bad and, you know, do a deep dive analysis of those different things. While there's other podcasts out there that focus on completely different things, you know, we all shouldn't be doing the same exact thing anyway. You know this.
Yeah, totally. And we should all, and all of us have different flavors. I talk about this in the atheist movement a lot. Like, I interviewed, you know, David Silverman, who's like a hardcore atheist activist, who is like a firebrand atheist. Like, he's proud of the fact that he's a new atheist and that he's like really staunch about it.
Yep.
And then I have interviewed other people, like maybe Hemant or, you know, a couple of other atheists who are a little softer about it. And it's good because it does take all types, because if everybody were the same way, huge swaths of the population wouldn't be reached.
Yeah. I mean, the mass appeal thing, I look at it like you need to just be yourself and pick what audience you want to talk to.
Totally. You know, you almost don't even have to pick your audience. If you just are yourself, people will naturally like gravitate towards that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, just do what you're good at and do what you want to do. Like, do the thing that entertains you, that'll keep you in the game. You got to enjoy what you're doing, right? Like, you know, especially if it's not your day job. In my situation, like, I have a full-time job and I have a second full-time job, which is the podcast and all the other stuff that we do. But the bottom line is, you know, I encourage everyone, whenever anybody emails me and says, I want to get into activism, I want to do whatever, podcast, blog, whatever it is, my advice is almost verbatim the same thing. You have got to carve out your own niche. Do something mm-hmm. that somebody else isn't doing. Find things you're interested in. Do it in a different way. Focus on just a different corner of this, you know, even the same thing that other people are doing, but put your own twist on it that gives it value. You know, so at least you're not a carbon copy, because that's, you know, to me, like, that's the last thing that someone should be doing.
No, it's true. And it'll help you in whatever depth you want to dive. Like, if you have a blog and your blog is a thing that's so you that nobody else has to offer, then all of a sudden people are going to go, oh, this is the only place I can find this. And then that translates, even like for me, that was a big part of my growing pains when I first started, when I transitioned from graduate school into production, basically, is like, what can I do? I mean, I can host, but there's a million different like big boob blonde haired hosts out there who are like, look, I'm going to Rio de Janeiro to learn about FIFA or like something. Right. It's like, who cares? But so I do the science thing. I do this skepticism thing. I do this like, well, let's like try and make the news a little bit smarter. And it's almost like not there yet. But the nice thing is, even though the niche doesn't quite exist and I'm trying to carve it out, I don't have a lot of competition.
Yeah. Yeah. And, look, some people are going to find success and other people won't. And it's always a crapshoot in any endeavor that you want to do that you love. You know, if you want to be a movie star, you know, the odds are very low.
I
still think you should try it. At least, you know, put a time limit on it or reinvent yourself and try something else. But in the end, you know, I'm bringing value by the sheer fact that I'm passionate about it. I really care about the result. I want people to benefit desperately. I want them to gain something from listening. So we try to pack that information into the show, you know, just keep it chock full of useful, provocative information. And I was lucky, you know, I was very fortunate that people connected with us. And, you know what I'm talking about. You know, you develop an audience and they get you.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful place to be. So I highly encourage people, like, you know, get out there and do anything. Talk about it. It doesn't have to be what I'm doing. Like, talk about whatever you want. It's just a wonderful thing to do.
And it doesn't have to be to a huge audience. It's just like we were talking about earlier, the difference between, you know, 20 people in the room and 5,000 people in the room is a difference. And you are effective at different levels. Like, I'm actually not that good at, if I just run into somebody at a restaurant and strike up a conversation, I'm not as good one-on-one at, because I'm a little socially awkward and weird at, like, you know, having a real discussion about skepticism. It's a little like stressful to me to do that in public situations with people I don't know in like a small group setting. But in front of a microphone, I feel much freer. Whereas on the flip side, you could be affecting real change by talking to your coworkers or talking to your family members, even a very small group of people, or doing a blog that not that many eyes are on. You could really be affecting people's lives.
That's an interesting point, Carrot. Like, there are people, like, they just want to get advice from us on how do I talk to my family.
Yeah.
And that's really their goal. That's all they want to get out of it. You know, that's what they'd like to accomplish. They still, yeah, they still want to listen and everything, and they want to be a part of the community, but they just want this little nugget of like, how do I do it? So I find that to be fascinating as well, because that's a completely different type of communication. I happen to have developed it because I grew up in like a conflicted environment like that, with my sister being a born again Christian. You know, I have, mm-hmm, I have good advice that I give people if they ask for it. But even still, you know, the bottom line is everybody's looking to communicate with somebody. And I think there's a massive benefit to learning about critical thinking and skepticism. It's the tool that will improve your life.
I completely agree. All right. On that note, I want to go ahead and just do the last thing that I always do on the podcast, which is my favorite two questions. And so I want to put those to you and see what your answers are. The first question being, when you look to the future in whatever context you like, whether it's personal or global or whatever, what is the most concerning to you? What keeps you up at night? And on the flip side of that, what are you most optimistic about? What are you excited for?
Yeah, so the thing that I'd say I'm the most concerned about is humanity has a really amazing blind spot. And I think that it's very possible that we're not going to make the changes that we need to socially to fix things. You know, I very much worry about like global warming, as an example, catching up to us.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I said earlier in the show, like, we're very susceptible to our own dependency on technology. That's a really big concern of mine. Like, an EMP could take out any major city or a country if it's high enough in the atmosphere with the way, mm-hmm, that things are today. So we have to be, our technology can't own us. I think we need to move very strongly and steadily forward and vet out the things that it makes us vulnerable to. That's the negative. And I think if anything takes down humanity, it's going to be from that. It's going to be like a technology-based tragedy. Mm-hmm. The thing I'm the most optimistic about is, you know, I think humans have a massive exploratory backbone. I think that we're just compelled to continue to learn. And I think that's amazing. It's amazing that we have the brains that we do and that we can think the way that we can. And there's something about curiosity that drives us crazy. Like, we have to turn over that next stone. And I think if things go well over the next few hundred years, that humanity is going to evolve into, and when I mean evolve, I mean we're going to self-evolve ourselves into magnificent beings. As crazy as that sounds, we're going to effect deliberate evolution on ourselves and become something much more profound than we are today.
I love that. And I don't think it sounds that crazy. I mean, we're already doing it. It's like aging. Like, you don't notice how much older you've gotten until you look at a photo. Like, there are things that are happening even right now, but because we're living in it, we don't notice.
Exactly, right. So the slow change, you don't notice the slow little changes, but you look, mm-hmm, back. You know, I'm 46 years old, so I'm older than you, and it's like I'm accelerating in a way in how things are changing in my mind. You know, I'm just not that guy I was when I was 20 anymore.
Yeah.
So I have this awesome perspective, like, wow, I'm really seeing, you know, my emotions evolve, the depth of, you know, what I can feel, and the thing, you know, it's just, everything is different.
And, yeah.
But and take that though, Kara, to like, our technology is merging. Like, we're becoming a merged species with our technology, with, you know, we're going to be cyborgs. We're going to be implanting devices. We're going to be genetically engineering people, you know, mm-hmm, and like I said, what was the first thing I said? Watch out for technology, because it's dangerous. It's wonderful, but it's dangerous. And we have to be cautious of it. Like, a nuclear bomb is the perfect example of just technology in the wrong place. Like, don't do that. So
there's big concerns with, like, synthetic biology, for example, like making new organisms. Like, what kinds of effects can that have?
Exactly right. And look at, you know, Elon Musk. Like, who's the other person that's joining him and making sure that the singularity does not overrun humanity.
Oh yeah, he's like really freaked out about that. But so is Stephen Hawking, I think.
Yeah, I forget. I don't think it was Hawking that joined him, but there's two of them. Was it Bill Gates? I can't remember. But the two of them essentially said, we're not going to allow it to happen. We're going to put a layer of intelligence in there just to make sure that this doesn't happen. I mean, look,
but then you have other people who are actively trying to make it happen.
Well, we need both. We do. Yeah. We need the people, the entrepreneurs, to get out there and you know, put the time and energy and money into developing these new technologies, but we need the intelligence behind it to rein it back in, bring it down to reality, and make it have true value and not like a fake value that ends up doing something negative, right? Just like anything, name any other technology, vaccines. Like, yes, they could have been very dangerous, but the scientists did a very good job of developing it and vetting it out and making sure that it's healthy. And now we reap the massive benefits of this wonderful technology called vaccinations. But the singularity.
Yeah, but there is always a dark side, you know? There's always a dark side. You can look at places where people were intentionally vaccinated with one thing, but they were told they were like, you know, it's fucked up. Like, there's always a dark side, and we do have to keep an eye on that and make sure that we keep our government accountable and make sure that we keep ourselves accountable.
Exactly.
And that regulation actually is in place. And I think that going to what you were saying about, like, how there is this evolution, like we are evolving ourselves. And then I mentioned that it's happening already, but it's so slow, like we don't notice. Think about your childhood and, like, you know, look back through the, like, you know, the color photos that are kind of a wash. And then before that, you know, we have older people in the black and white photos or the sepia photos. And think about, like, what school was like for you and what tools you were using when you were young.
Right.
And then think about how kids are now, who are, like, swiping magazine pages because they don't understand why they don't turn like an iPad. And I've brought this up before. Children now in school are learning coding the way that we learned English,
right?
Or maybe our second language if we went to a school where we were lucky enough, like a Montessori, to like learn Spanish or something. So there is a language. Kids are growing up to naturally speak in the language of computers. And so the way that we will, like, make fun of grandma because grandma, like, doesn't understand self-checkout or she needs really big buttons on her cell phone, like, think about how old we are going to seem when we're old.
Exactly.
Like, when our kids are like, you don't know how to write that program.
And
like,
this is in one generation. I mean, you know, if you look at the differences between the last, like, five generations and the things that they encountered, you know, like, my grandfather was alive before a car existed, right? You know, now
so crazy.
I know, like, it is snowballing, and you were very smart to say.
Yes, it's Moore's law too. It's like it's happening exponentially.
But let me tell you something, Kara. This is the thing I don't want humanity to lose, and that's our humanity. Like, okay, so yeah, they're learning code at an earlier age, and they're interacting in a very different way than you and I were with our peers at their age, but, you know, what are the best things in life? You know, think about it. Like, me coming home from work and kissing my wife is a moment that I look forward to every day. Like, mm-hmm. I'm dying to see her. That human interaction, to me, blows away everything else in the world. It's like that me picking up my son and having him say daddy, you know, he's 2 years old, and it's like every neuron in my head is firing when that happens. That's better than anything. That's better than the fucking internet times a million. Like, I'd trade that in a second. And that's something that's has always been there since the first human looked at the other human and said, wow, I think I love this other person, all the way to today. Like,
I don't think we're at risk of losing that. I really don't.
I hope
think
not.
That's just something that's so fundamental to our biology. It's so fundamental to our psychology that we will never want to not have that. But on the flip side, I do think that younger people and younger generations who are exposed to this kind of, there's always a fear, right? This dystopian fear that it's going to make us less connected somehow. But I think that there's an empathy that is being developed in young people that wasn't developed in older people because we were so used to staying only in our own community and feeling very tribal. And I think that young people now are able to get online and access the same thing that somebody in Ghana can access.
Yeah.
And they can, within an instant, they can see what it's like to live in Bangladesh. And they can understand the struggles of somebody in Peru. And because they can do that, the world has gotten so much smaller and it's gotten, I think, less tribal.
I agree. I think there's you know, it's an opportunity for humanity to have more of a collective. The internet certainly provides that. I mean, look at what happened in France, you know, like everybody, like, you know, the exact opposite of what those terrorists wanted to happen is happening. And that mm-hmm. the world
exactly.
community is basically saying, we saw what you did, right? Thanks to the internet. Everybody knows about it. Everybody's pissed off about it and turned off by it. And everyone's like, fuck you.
Yeah.
That's the power of the internet and the modern age. I totally agree. Everything that you just said is spot on. I just I just think, though, that at the end of the day, I think the point I was trying to make was the most wonderful things are the things that were there thousands of years ago.
Yes. Yes, that's true. And we can, for example, make amazing food science, nutrition, and molecular gastronomy and in vitro meat and all of this stuff. But our bodies are really craving local ingredients from right around our houses. Like our body, you know, there are things that are like the more rustic and the less touch they are, in some ways, like the more comforting and even healthy they are. Going back to that Bobby Fischer quote, there's nothing so healing as a human touch.
I know.
It just comes back to that.
It's perfect. Like I can't top that. It is a wonderful statement, and the sentiment to me is like, that's what makes us human, you know? Like, you could forget about all the other stuff. Like, it's there as luxuries. It makes our lives easier. It gives me more time to kiss my wife, right? I don't have to hand wash my clothes. Thank you.
Exactly. Yes, you got the machine so that you can have more quality time. Yeah. I've done a lot of studies, or not studies, but like stories where I've gone and talked to roboticists, and they always say the same things: dull, dirty, dangerous. The whole goal of most modern roboticists is to make machines that will do the dull things, the dirty things, and the dangerous things so that we don't have to.
Yep.
And that will allow us to be safer and to have more quality time, which is just epic. And on that note, we have gone for so long, which was so exciting because you were just so much fun to talk to. I do want to make sure before we go that everybody who's listening, the very small percentage of them who have never listened to the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast, or who maybe don't know where to reach out to you on Twitter, on Facebook, like, let them know what you're up to and where they can find you.
Just go to www.theskepticsguide.org and you can see everything that we do, you know, YouTube videos, our podcasts, live events. And, you know, just listen to the show. I hope you enjoy it.
Indeed. Well, Jay, thank you so much for joining me. It was so much fun. And everybody who's listening, thank you for stopping by, too. I'm really looking forward to the next time that we all get together to talk nerdy.